know how that rat face could do a thing like that?
She's got no heart in her. She's a swivel-eyed get.
She wants pole axing.
Some people have knocked on their own mother. They're living in a jungle, yeah, I don't know.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling, and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Never mind the Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman's bloody role in Yemen, what about his role in the 9/11 attacks and his royal family? We're joined by author of 9/11 The New Evidence, an organiser of UK-based Reinvestigate 9/11, which is calling for a proper inquiry into the real perpetrators of the 2001 9/11 attacks. Ian Henshaw. And also, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn's call for a ban on UK arms sales, not to Saudi Arabia, but to Israel. Why has he done it? And more importantly, why has it not been reported anywhere in the UK press? It's in the Israeli newspapers, but not here. And links between the Israelis and the Indian government may have played a part in the recent bomb attack in Kashmir, inflaming tensions between two nuclear-armed states. Why is veteran Middle East journalist Robert Fisk pointing his finger at Tel Aviv? Is he an anti-Semite too? And the Northern Ireland Troubles, possibly reopening of the case against the British Army on Bloody Sunday, as the Northern Ireland Secretary says in the Commons, the police and army were above the law. Their killings weren't crimes. And she's still in her job. A documentary also has been suppressed about the supposedly loyalist Lochan Island Massacre. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. This week, a new political discussion group for Bristol based at Triodos Bank. And also turmoil over gender reassignment in the Bristol Labour Party, with Pamela Beamish and Esther Giles being banned from standing two Labour members as candidates for alleged statements relating to the matter. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. We start by welcoming Ian Henshaw to the studio. Thanks very much for dropping by, Ian.
It's a pleasure.
Could you just give us a brief outline of the Saudi links to the September the 11th attacks? Because we've seen a lot of criticism of Saudi Arabia this week again, and also the exposure over the last couple of months that they've for a long time had top level intelligence links to Israel. But can we start with the links to the 9/11 attacks, which we were told, really, weren't we, that something was going on in Afghanistan, but actually it was bin Laden and he's a Saudi?
Well, Tony, you know, it would take me a lot longer than you've got to list all those links, and we're not talking speculation, we're talking about officially admitted statements. You know, we've got leaks from, well, we've got stuff that the FBI has been forced to reveal. We've got Inspector General's reports into the CIA activities at the time of 9/11. And what's coming out, beyond any serious doubt, based on FBI agents who handled the case, yes, Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabian government was involved in the 9/11 attacks. Nobody is really denying that.
Okay,
now.
So how exactly?
How? They supplied the alleged hijackers. We don't really know if those guys really did fly the planes or not, but they were very crucial to the official story. They were supplied by Saudi Arabia, and they were given visas by the American State Department when they should never have been given visas.
So how come you say they? We don't know if they flew the planes or not. Well, I mean, surely that's a basic part of the investigation.
Well, that's the official story, but we also know there was an anti-hijack operation going on that morning, which probably involved just a coincidence, we're told. But that anti-hijack exercise would have involved remote control of aircraft taking them over. The reason this sounds, you know, far-fetched, the reason people are thinking down those lines is because at least one of the pilots was obviously hopelessly unqualified and could not possibly have flown the plane the way he did. So either they haven't got the right people, or the planes weren't flown by suicide hijackers. They weren't steered.
What do pilots, professional pilots, have to say about this?
Professional pilots are amazingly unwilling to make any comments. Architects and engineers, there's thousands of them saying how, you know, the towers couldn't have collapsed the way
seen some stuff about some professional pilots have made comments on the amazing manoeuvre that have been done by the aircraft that supposedly hit the Pentagon.
I know, exactly. And that pilot, the alleged pilot of that, he'd been, you can find it on record, you know, he'd been dismissed from flight schools. Hani Hanjour was kicked out of flight schools because he wasn't considered safe on a small plane, and we're now told to believe that he flew a big plane down, almost a military, it was described at the time as a military manoeuvre, and then flew at ground level and then just happened to hit the part of the Pentagon that had just been recently reinforced and was empty of people, by and large empty of people. The 9/11 is full of these bizarre stories, and if it was anybody but the official sources telling us these things, they'd be laughed out of court as conspiracy theories.
What about remote control of aircraft? Have you got any actual real hard evidence that that's possible?
Oh, it is possible. I mean, they've had drone aircraft since the Second World War. The only question is, you know, what was happening on 9/11? That's just a theory. It's just a possibility. But you have to come up with something, because Hani Hanjour couldn't have flown that plane.
Why do you think the Saudis did get involved, if they did get involved? What was the motive there?
Well, I'll just read out a couple of quotes I've just been sifting through Newsweek. And the interesting thing is that you can now find out things in the mainstream American media, which only people like me and you were saying 10 years ago. We've turned out to be, dare I say it, horribly right, and now they're finally admitting it. Government-wide cover-up, that's what Newsweek are calling it. New York Post, Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the United States at the time, who was a very close friend of George Bush. Bandar should have been a suspect, and that's what the FBI thought. Instead of giving him a special entourage to protect him from arrest and flying him home as quickly as they did, they could have. He should actually have been a suspect. He should be in jail. Saudi Arabia and the CIA conspired. That's Newsweek. So that gets back to your question: why would the Saudis do it? The Saudis don't do anything without the say-so from America, and recently they've admitted now that that's when they set up their string of Wahhabist Saudi, Islamic sort of setups all over the world. Mosques.
Sort of schools, colleges.
Yeah, the schools, like that, the colleges and madrasas. And they've admitted now, the new guy, KSM or whatever he's called, he's now admitting
MBS.
he's now admitting, or he's stated, that, you know, they did it because the Americans asked them to. This wasn't something that happened, oh dear, you know, like the American establishment will tell you publicly, oh dear, the Saudis are a little bit naughty, they're beyond our control. No, and here we are saying CIA and Saudi Arabia conspired, and that's Newsweek. That's not Tony or Ian, that's Newsweek. Why won't the rest of the media take any notice of it? Heaven alone knows. Why have they taken 10 years to tell us this, what was obvious from the statements of FBI officers 10 years ago? Goodness knows. For
well,
some
tell you,
reason
tell you
they've
what
decided
I'll do
to tell us.
Put up a link on our show page to those articles you've just, the headlines you've just read out at thisweek.org.uk. So if you don't believe us, just go and have a look and ask yourself, why is the mainstream press not covering this? What's your answer to that question?
I think that, I mean, I don't have an easy answer. I used to spend hours talking to a guy on The Independent, and when he finally, I gave him the story, you know, all based on American sources, he didn't have to believe a word of me. You know, it doesn't matter who I was. I gave him the references to read it in the government reports and the statements of FBI officers. They just wouldn't run it. And I thought, well, I don't know why he spent hours talking to me and then wouldn't run something that was rock solid. Instead, they went with another story about the Saudis involved in 9/11, which is a perfectly good story. But the really key one is about the CIA's involvement in 9/11 and the way they protected the alleged hijackers from being arrested by the FBI. And there's some very angry people now in Washington who are beginning to realise that the CIA is up to its eyeballs in the 9/11 attacks. We don't know quite how. We don't know if they were just stupid. It rather looks as if they would knew exactly what they were doing. They kept the information as to what they were up to from the guy who they should have been reporting to, who's now very angry, a guy called Richard Clark. He'll tell anybody who listens that he was deceived and never should have been left out in the out of the loop by the CIA. They had no legal right to do that. He was in charge of the CIA from the White House, and he never knew nothing about these hijackers that the CIA knew all about.
Is anyone from the heart of government in the early noughties spoken out, gone public, and said, "Well, look, you know, this is a government conspiracy to cover this up"?
Well, the most interesting guy who has said that is a guy called von Bülow, Andreas von Bülow, who's a West German politician, and he brought out a book that was in the title was "The CIA and 9/11," and within 2 years of 9/11, or even, I think even of a year, he'd come to that conclusion. He's probably the biggest expert on the intelligence services in the whole of the political world. He sat on a committee that was investigating the German intelligence services, who from time to time get caught out organising right-wing, extreme right-wing groups, which they then run. That's another story. You've probably run that. I don't know.
What about the links then between Saudi Arabia and the United States? Because we've got, I think it was 1945, the Great Bitter Lake meeting between Roosevelt and Abdulaziz, who was then the king of Saudi Arabia. This seems to have kind of started a very strong... I mean, actually, you could even go back to the First World War.
Well, I was just going to say, goes back to...
And the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which the British put in place.
Yeah.
What is the nature
Lawrence
of that...
Lawrence of Arabia.
What is the nature of that sort of post-World War II relationship between the US and Saudi Arabia? Obviously, oil is flowing in one direction. Is it just money going the other way, or is it other parts to that deal, do you think?
We pay our money for their oil, and then they use what was our money to buy our arms. So really what's happening is that there's a sort of hidden tax. The price we pay for oil represents a hidden tax, which is then used to subsidise the military-industrial complex. And Saudi, I'm not an expert on this, but I think you'll speak to military experts, they'll tell you Saudi Arabia is paying well over the market price, like 10 times, you know, really seriously over the market price for the arms that we supply them, because it's just an accounting scam, basically.
Martin, we've got keep hearing actually over the last 4 or 5 years about the oil price falling. It's not falling at the petrol pumps here by any means, is it? In fact, it's edging up even more.
Well, the other aspect of the relationship between the Saudis and the Americans is the petrodollar system. Essentially, because the Saudis are the dominant force in OPEC because of their oil, they've got the biggest oil reserves, they've enforced that OPEC countries will only take payments for oil in dollars. Now, that means that the dollar is the world's reserve currency. Before 1971, the dollar was the world's reserve currency, was based on gold. The petrodollar system is based up because you've got to have dollars to buy oil.
But those dollars aren't necessarily based on anything. They're just
dollars. Well, no, they're just printed. But of course, the point is, every country in the world has to have a low pile of dollars to buy their oil, and that means that the Americans can run a massive budget deficit. They can run the military-industrial complex on tick. Yeah, but the whole thing is dependent. The whole thing is absolutely interrelated, and of course, it's potentially going to crash because the Chinese and the Russians are looking to create an alternative currency system where their currencies, the yuan and the ruble, will be based ultimately on gold. There'll still be some movement for it. The Bretton Woods system did allow some flexibility, and ultimately if the dollar is taken away as the world's reserve currency, the US economy will crash, and that will be the end of their empire.
Well, we're always hearing about Saudi Arabia's massive oil reserves, but actually the largest oil reserves in the world are in Venezuela, which has really been hotting up over the last few weeks. What's your take on Maduro and what's been happening there, Martin?
Well, the Venezuelan oil is a very poor quality, although there's apparently a lot of good quality oil just in a disputed area between Venezuela and Guyana, which is another issue. Well, what's happened? They've basically been very, very open about the fact that they're going to get rid of... I mean, Pompeo the other week was saying that Maduro could end up like Gaddafi, and he also said, well, he might end up on a beach somewhere, like in Guantanamo. And of course, Maduro is the elected president of Venezuela. I mean, if you look at the opinion polls and everything, he won the election. The opposition boycotted the election because they knew they couldn't win. but he had a turnout comparable to any turnout in US elections, and he won 64% of that vote, which is far higher than most politicians of the West, far higher than Donald Trump or Theresa May, for example. But he's not allowed to be the president because we've declared some other guy, Guaido. Most 80% of people in Venezuela hadn't heard who Guaido was when they declared that, when the Americans declared him president. So most people didn't even know who he was. But an outside power has declared him president, and they've also threatened to invade. This is very dangerous, but the fact is, it's not worked.
Venezuela is surrounded by US proxy states, isn't it?
Hostile states, yeah.
Brazil, really, ultra-left, neo-Nazi, effectively, state in Brazil, or certainly fascist government. Has Maduro got the wherewithal? We just heard yesterday, didn't we, by the way, of a massive power cut in Caracas and right across large parts of Venezuela,
which they're blaming on sabotage.
So, surely, been a long war, using dirty tricks.
There was an attempt to assassinate.
The Americans might possibly be able to topple Maduro
Pompeo himself has said, if Kim Jong-un was to die suddenly, don't ask me any questions about it, but you know what the CIA is like. Yeah, they're basically being very, very gangsterish in the way they're approaching this, which has actually not worked. The population inside Venezuela, opinion polls show 80% are opposed to sanctions and 90% are opposed to military intervention. And if it turns into a military intervention, they'll be able to get in easily enough, but then they will face an Iraq scenario because they've got a pretty good military in Venezuela. They're pretty well prepared. They've been preparing for this battle for a long time. And the US ground forces will get in easily enough, but then they'll be chewed to bits like they were in Iraq.
What would you like me to...
I just wonder what your take on Venezuela and Maduro.
I think it takes longer, than we think. I think that, yes, they have threatened to invade, but I don't think the invasion is part of the plan for another few years yet. They're going to weaken the country as much as they possibly can through viciously effective sanctions. Just on the optimistic side, I read a report, perhaps you can correct me, that the Brazilians have ruled out aiding and abetting an American invasion. So they have to come in from Colombia, and then you've got Cuba. I think it's a lot of this is bluff on the Americans' part at the moment. They're trying to persuade the public to overthrow Maduro rather than actually being.
They're trying to persuade the army, which is hopeless because, of course, the army's been purged because of the coup in 2002. All the bad wood was kicked out at that stage.
Let's just be correct. It was a coup attempt. Wasn't
a coup attempt.
That failed.
That's right. But at that point, the army. Don't forget, Chavez was originally a paratroops lieutenant colonel. But what's happened this week, which has not been reported in the Western media, is two Russian prankster comedians who are actually well known for these things phoned up Elliot Abrahams, who's the Iran-Contra gargoyle from the past who's been put in charge of Venezuela policy, and they phoned him up pretending to be the Swiss foreign ministry, and he believed them, and he chatted with them for an hour about what the strategy was with Venezuela, and he said, we don't intend to invade, but we want to freak them out, and that eventually, ultimately, we're just going to try and bring them down with sanctions, etc. Now, of course, at the same time, they're trying to say we're going to bring in humanitarian aid, at the same time as the Bank of England has seized $1.5 billion of gold that the Venezuelans have in good faith deposited at the Bank of England. They said, can we have it back? He said, no, you can't.
We saw set fire to aid trucks, but there is evidence that that was actually done
by the anti-Maduro people to make sure they could get a picture of the aid trucks being torched, but it was their people who did it.
It's now, pretty shameful that the EU... Is the EU now officially? Because its friends were standing...
The EU officially isn't going along with it, but various EU countries are.
Right, including Britain.
Yeah.
Back to the 9/11 stuff. I wonder if you could just tell us, Ian, how the campaign started, the 9/11 Truth campaign here in the UK. Because, I think it took for most people a while to realise the implications of the crimes of the September 11th attacks and just what it was going to mean for the future, because it did take a while for us to realise, I think, it certainly did for me, that they were going to use this as an attempt to start this war on terror and to try and define the geopolitics of the 21st century.
Well, yeah, I mean, America really needed, the American ruling elite really needed something like 9/11. When you look back at the situation, as it was a week before 9/11, it was looking terrible. terrible for them. Bush was extremely unpopular. Most people thought he'd stolen the election. That all went out the window with 9/11. Israel was also extremely unpopular. Colin Powell had just virtually been kicked out of a UN summit on Israel just a few weeks earlier. What else? There's pretty much everything. They'd had the World Trade plans had been stopped by the uprising in Seattle. I don't know if you remember that, but it was a major, major event at the time. And Clinton capitulated to the demands of the of people like us, you know, who don't want to see the big business taking over everything, which is what the trade deals were doing. So, you know, the elite in the West was definitely beleaguered. You know, they hadn't managed to get rid of Saddam Hussein. They'd lost their influence in Afghanistan. So, and 9/11 solved all these things. And don't even let's start talking about Israel's public image, you know, and how suddenly Israel was everybody's friend because they could give you advice on anti-terrorism. You know, Muslim terror, that's our speciality, isn't it? Israeli technical suppliers or military advisors or whatever. So, you know, that's when 9/11 sits in the general scheme of things. And how extraordinary it was that very day that the media right across the West, they all used the same thing. This changes everything. You know, this changes everything. And they meant it. A lot of people didn't quite realise how much they did mean it.
Well, I had a little bit of a weird thing happen to me on the September the 11th itself, which was I was on an email sharing list with a friend of mine, called Martian, his nickname. Anyway, he called it Martian's List. And I saw just, I suppose it would be 10 a.m. here, I saw an article on the BBC which was saying that the Chilean government were going to be prosecuting Henry Kissinger for war crimes for the coup, and that was the same morning for the 1973, I think it was, wasn't it, coup in Chile, and that he was going to be prosecuted. So basically, if he ever came and stepped foot on Chilean soil, that he would be prosecuted, and also they were going to do what they could through international law to get him and to prosecute him and to jail him for it. And I flippantly tweeted, oh, he's going to have to start World War III now to distract our attention. And later in the day, of course, saw all this stuff going on. But, I mean, it did take me a while. I think probably the first I saw was Thierry Masson's book. It was called Pentagate, I think, was the very first thing I saw, which popped through my letterbox. I picked that up and started reading it. But it slowly dawned on me, I suppose, after the first 18 months or so, that something needed to be done to scotch the lies of the 9/11. And one of the main figures who was involved in actually getting the campaign together here in the UK was Ian Neil. And he sadly died recently of brain cancer at a very early age. I think it was 53, 50s. Something like that. Anyway, can you just say what Ian Neil's role was? Because I know you were involved in the early days too, sort of starting things going, to actually bring people together and saying, well, look, we're going to have to get organised here and oppose this narrative.
Yeah, well, I just got an email, a stray email, saying somebody's called a meeting for 9/11 skeptics. I'm not sure if we were using that phrase at that point, but for people who were worried about this. And there was about eight of us in a pub, and Ian Neil was one of them. There was a sort of mixed bunch of people from different, very different political backgrounds, which has been a problem for the 9/11 Truth Movement, because talking about the major parties being split, the 9/11 Truth Movement has a range of different factions in it, you know, and some of them will tell you that other ones of them are lunatics and so on and so on. You know, I generally try to stick to what's been admitted by the governments, because you know you can't really. It's much harder for people in the establishment, at least, to you know stonewall you if you're pointing out to things that were in U.S. government reports.
But Ian Neil was an engineer doing things like working on bringing water supplies through charities to.
Oh, he was a wonderful guy.
Africa, places like that.
He was a very high-powered guy.
What was it that drew him to it? Do you think? What was his main take on it all?
I think he was basically, you know, to oversimplify, you could possibly say he was an anarchist, very suspicious of government. So, you know, I mean, that's the one thing that everybody's got in common in the 9/11 Truth Movement, is we're suspicious of government. We don't believe official statements unless we see something more substantial to back them up.
And what was his role?
Well, he did a lot of organising. He did a lot of work, really, just contacting people, trying to get support, posting onto so-called alternative websites who weren't interested. It was quite frightening the extent to which people you would expect to at least listen weren't even prepared to listen to anything about 9/11.
I mean, I think in the early days it must have been quite a thankless task.
Well, it has been for many years, Tony, I can tell you. Still is. But it's even more spectacular now because you've got Newsweek, you know, you've got the parts of the American media gradually beginning to admit and fess up. To cheer myself up, Ken Livingstone apparently told one of our supporters that, you know, if we're right about 9/11, it'll be 150 years before they tell us the truth. And, you know, I don't think any of us will live that long, but who knows? I think the general public's more aware than the elite. The worst people are Guardian readers, actually, because they believe everything. If the Guardian were to tell them 9/11 was an inside job, they'd all believe it straight away. But you try telling them when the Guardian's not telling them that, it's an impossible task.
Well, Martin Summers, I know you were involved in the early days as well. What drew you to it?
Well, I, on the day it happened, I pretty much immediately knew that it was wrong, and a friend of mine came into the room and said, look, there's been an attack on America, isn't it great, it's about time they got their come up. And so I said, you've got this wrong. And I realised immediately that it was wrong, and then I looked up what was going to happen. There's a seminar at the London School of Economics three weeks hence about the future of American power, where an old friend of mine, Peter Gowan, who's now dead, was going to be debating with the guy called Mort Dworkin III, political attaché at the US Embassy, about the future of American power. So I paid my 25 quid and went down to London to go to this seminar with a leaflet which I'd got from my research on the internet, because the first thing that drew my attention was that John O'Neill, who was the deputy head of the FBI, had written a book with Brissard and Dasky, who were ex-intelligence agents from France and journalists, called Bin Laden, La Vérité Interdite. And and basically, what O'Neill was saying was that he'd been chasing down Bin Laden.
That's the forbidden truth, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, he was going to chase down Bin Laden. Every time he tried to chase down Bin Laden, he was protected by the Bush family. So I got this, and I turned it into a little leaflet, and I went to the seminar. I tried to put my hand up to speak in the seminar, and of course there's lots of windbags there, so you couldn't get a word in. And at the end of it, I just stood up with a sign saying, why did FBI man resign? Answer, because Bush was protecting Bin Laden. Anyway, the security then threw me out, because you're not allowed to protest in seminars, and they threw me out onto the pavement outside the LSE. And I said, well, can I stand here on the pavement? They said, yes, you can stand there. Anyway, I just handed leaflets out to all the people who had been in the seminar. Bonnie Greer was there, if you know her, American author. So I was talking to all these people, showing them, you know, this is all the stuff about what John O'Neill had been saying. John O'Neill himself died in the attack, because he became head of security at the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And he died in the attack. But anyway, I didn't know that at the time. Anyway, I thought the guy was probably going to go out the back, Mort Dworkin III. I thought he's just gone out the back. I was about to give up. But basically, he stayed inside because he didn't want to talk to me. And then he came out.
And he spied you, you think?
He realised that I was the problem. Anyway, but I was there for about an hour and a half. I was just about to give up. He must have gone out the back way. Anyway, eventually he appeared in the doorway. And I went up to him and said, you do realise that the deputy director of the FBI resigned in June because he said Bush was protecting Bin Laden, don't you? And he was scowling, really scowling. He didn't want to talk to me. He said, yeah, John O'Neill, we know. I said, well, we know too, mate, and don't forget it. That's how I got involved.
And what about Ian Neill? Because you must have known him at fairly
early. Well, I met Ian Neill at the same time as I did my own activism on 9/11 before I came across either of you two guys.
Yeah. I remember we met up.
I met you on Stop the War demos, didn't you? And you were handing out those deception dollars. And I thought, right, this is a fellow spirit.
Yeah.
And it turned out that we both actually had been at Oxford. Some people, and we knew other people.
Some
that we
people
knew other
will
people,
say,
didn't we?
Ian Henshaw, some people will say, well, you've been banging your against a brick wall all these years, really, and you've got nowhere.
Well, who knows what would have happened, you know, but I did write a book which was serialised in the Daily Mail, which sold about 40,000 copies. So, you know, I don't know. I think arguably there is no democracy, there is no truth, and there's no point, you know, but then that's very pessimistic. We all have to live in hope. You can't expect one person. I mean, it wouldn't be a very democratic society if I could determine what everybody thought. It'd be as bad as if the Prime Minister could, you know, so you just have to plug away. away and leave it to other people to decide.
If you could just
pick
out three or four points from the book, I mean, what was the
I'll tell you one thing. I know what you're going to ask. You're going to say, when did I first think? Because I always get asked this on radio programs. When did I first get suspicious? And like Martin, it was really actually on day one, when I heard that a passport had been found from one of the alleged hijackers. And I just thought, that can't be quite right, you know, with all everything going on in New York this today, you know, with paper and rubbish and dust and ashes, you know, 6 inches deep in the pavement. They're telling us that somebody found a passport, the passport survived the air crash, fluttered down to the ground, was found by somebody, and then the police had time to look at this lost passport and identify it as one of the hijackers and put the news out on the mass media within a couple of hours.
What, Martin, what do you make of this whole hijacker conundrum? Were there hijackers that actually hijacked the aircraft or not?
I think I agree with Ian that we should stick to what we can prove rather than speculate. But one of the things I first picked up on is that they admitted, and perhaps Ian can correct me if I'm wrong, that none of the alleged hijackers appeared on the passenger lists that were issued by the airlines.
Yes, that were issued by the airlines.
Yeah.
But later, documents purporting to be flight manifests were released, and it did appear that people of those names that they've identified.
Didn't some of them survive afterwards somehow? I mean,
that's another story that goes round, and it's quite likely, but actually, you can't nail it down when you do the research.
Well, I understood that in the Daily Telegraph and the BBC, various people who were named as hijackers came forward. One was in it, said, "Well, actually, we are those people, and we're still alive, and here we are."
I think this must be a bit weird.
Nobody's.
To be a hijacker or a terrorist, and you're seeing it on television and saying, "Hang on, that's me. I didn't do that. I'm not dead."
The problem is that Saudis have names. It's a bit like saying, "Oh, there's this hijacker called John Smith," and then a lot of other people getting up and saying, "Well, I'm John Smith and I'm not the hijacker." The issue is, if it's the ones with the photos, it gets very murky, Tony.
Let's just move to look at motive, 9/11 motive. Did the Saudis have a motive for it?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, their motive would have been just to do what the CIA, you know, ingratiate
themselves. So they didn't. They were just under orders.
Prince Bandar, you know, was a very old and close friend of the Bush family, and Bush badly needed something.
Martin,
he was in terrible
is there
trouble.
You can think of as
well,
a motive?
Well, Turki bin Faisal, who was head of Saudi Mukhabarat, the intelligence service, and he eventually became ambassador to Britain. And he was asked in a press conference that he gave what he knew about 9/11 and whether Saudi Arabia was involved. And what he said is, "You'd better ask George Bush about that," is what he said.
Bringing all things up to date, I mean, we are supposed to be a news programme, that is sort of looking at the background, but one of the stories I saw this week was really pretty shocking by a chap called Chris Hedges on Truth Dig, was giving the bomb to Saudi Arabia's Dr. Strangelove is the headline. The most dangerous thing, foreign policy decision of the Trump administration, and I know that's saying a lot, he says, is its decision to share sensitive nuclear technology with Saudi Arabia and authorise US companies to build nuclear reactors in the country. He spent several years in the Middle East, and I covered, he says, the despotic, repressive kingdom in the Middle East as bureau chief for the New York Times. I, along with most Arabists in the US, have little doubt that giving nuclear capability to Saudi Arabia under the leadership of ruthless and amoral Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman would see it embark on a nuclear weapons program and eventually share weaponized technology with the Saudi allies and proxies that include an army of radical jihadists and mortal enemies of America. A nuclearized Saudi Arabia is a grave existential threat to the Middle East and ultimately to the United States. Now, you first, Martin, do you think there's any substance to what Chris is saying there? He's saying this is basically not being reported, but it's one of the most important decisions the Trump administration have made.
Well, the stuff I've been reading, which is only rumour, is that the Israelis have already provided them with nuclear weapons because they're very close allies with the Saudis these days. I don't know whether that's true.
They always were, but it's come up.
Yeah.
There's one of these many things which was a conspiracy theory, and now they've confirmed it, you know, that actually they are our allies.
I mean, because they've got this idea that the Iranians got nuclear weapons and they've got to have them, or they're trying to get nuclear
weapons.
It's
about distracting the ordinary Arab public, isn't it?
According to Chris Hedges, this has been masterminded, this sharing of the nuclear technology with the Saudis, by a chap called Jared Kushner. Who is this guy?
That's the son-in-law of... Bush.
Trump, sorry.
What am I talking about? He's basically an amateurish, you know, property dealer from New York, but he's now playing geopolitics. I think if the Saudis got nuclear weapons, Putin made a speech some while ago. He said, if anybody uses nuclear weapons on us or any of our allies, meaning potentially Iran, we will go for it. We will nuke whoever does that. So in other words, getting nuclear weapons doesn't get the Saudis very far, because they can't be used short of Armageddon, and therefore there's not much point having them, which is what the Iranians have concluded.
Well, when Kevin Carhill was on here a few weeks ago, he pointed out that the US has just authorised the manufacture of a new series of mini-nukes.
Yeah.
The point being that battlefield commanders can use these mini-nukes, and it's a way of getting from a conventional war into a nuclear war. So that's always been considered like a big red line that you don't cross if you're a military commander, but with a mini-nuke you may be able to actually say, well, with a few of these things, maybe the other cyber will hit us back with a nuclear war, and then we can have what we want.
Well,
and I mean, the thing is, there's also, sorry to keep interrupting, I know you wanted to say something, Martin, but many people will say, well, nobody wants a nuclear war.
Well, that's true. I mean, what is the possible use of a mini nuke? The possible use
might
of
make money for the manufacturers.
Well, it makes money for the manufacturers. It's just a boondoggle, yes. And of course, there's no. I can't see any conceivable. I mean, what Putin said on a major foreign policy speech, some months ago, he said, if anybody uses nuclear weapons, even little ones, we stick by the strategic doctrine of the Russian general staff that's been since World War II. We will go all out straight away. Yeah. If you cross that line, we are going to give you the, we will go to heaven, but you will not even have time to pray before our missiles take you out. And therefore, they're going back to the old strategic doctrine, you use nuclear weapons, we are going to destroy you. And of course, at that point, they're not actually usable, unless you're really going to go for it. The idea that they will use a mini nuke on Iran, for example, and that the Russians will just sit back and say, oh, we're not going to do anything about that, or use a mini nuke, or just keep it at mini nuke level, not going to work.
It's called the W-76-2, this wonderful new device that the Americans have produced. And the context of this, Martin, of course, is that the US has just pulled out of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty with the Soviet Union.
Russia. But yes, it was signed with the Soviets,
but yeah, the context of this really being that the Americans, if they're going to have a fight with the Russians, that there's not a lot of support for that, for example, in Germany.
There isn't, but the Germans basically do as they're told. They're basically a vassal state of the US. I think you may disagree, Ian, because you've got a German wife. But I mean, in Germany, they don't. They're going to build the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, though. It's 70% completed. The Americans don't want them to build it, but it's being built. And by the end of this year, it'll be running.
The indication is the Germans didn't want to go into Syria, for example. They've had a big fight over Volkswagen as a result of that. What's your view on the extent to which Berlin is actually independent of what they're being told from Washington?
Very difficult question, complex, of course. I think basically in Germany, the Christian Democrats, who are the Conservative Party, are pro-American, and the Social Democrats aren't so pro-American. And so Nord Stream, was basically authorised by the Schroeder government, so I think you find when you look into it. Merkel, the thing of the I think there's a very sinister and deceptive relationship between Germany and America, because we all like to think that there's a good guy around somewhere. So it's the good guy, bad guy technique. And if you particularly look at Ukraine, in my opinion, Germany was very much of a major force behind the takeover of Ukraine by the far right, which they described as a revolution, but was actually a coup. And I was reading German foreign policy documents in the 1990s, and it was very clear that they felt that they had a right to Ukraine, and now they've got it basically and got it in the EU more or less. Okay,
well, it's not going to be in the EU. I think that's fanciful.
This relationship, this relationship between the EU and Britain post Brexit, and what foreign policy might look like, was also looked at by Stephen Sacker from the BBC in his conversations with Lord Ricketts. And so let's have a listen to that now. It's quite a fascinating conversation, really, with Lord Ricketts, the top civil servant and a national security advisor to David Cameron, saying that the picture was rather bleak, although he's not the only person who has knowledge in this field. And so Stephen Sacker put some of those opposite views to him.
You've also zeroed in on national security, and you bring to this a lot of experience because you were indeed David Cameron's national security advisor for a couple of years in his premiership. You and others, including John Sawyers, former head of MI6, have contended that the Brexit will do real, lasting, serious damage to Britain's national security and its sort of geopolitical standing in the wider world. Explain that to me.
Well, let's start with Britain's law and order, the cooperation that goes on between our police forces, those on the continent, our judicial authorities and those on the continent. I sit on a House of Lords committee which has looked at that and which has put out a report saying that we believe there are real risks for our security of leaving the EU without tying down a continuation of the cooperation that goes on under the EU instruments. At the moment, our police forces depend on databases, on confidential messaging systems, on a whole range of instruments to cooperate across borders with their European counterparts. We can only be part of those as a member of the EU. When we leave, we'll have to negotiate some sort of associate status.
We'll have to negotiate another status, another association, and given the import that everybody in Europe puts upon cooperation with Britain because of its very impressive record and a whole raft of different security agencies, there is almost no likelihood at all that Europe won't want very close security cooperation with the United Kingdom.
Well, what they say is that there are rules about who can be part of these EU instruments, and when you're a third country outside, you have to negotiate an associate status, which will give you less good access. And in some areas, like the European arrest warrant, some countries won't be willing to extradite their citizens to the UK at all. In others, there are EU instruments, but no country outside the EU is even an associate. So it's a complex field. It's going to take years of negotiation. And if we go ahead and leave before that's tied down, our law enforcement authorities will find it less easy to work. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner herself has said the same thing, so I'm far from being alone here. I think it's worth highlighting this.
Yeah, no question you're not alone, but it comes back to the same thing about subjectivity and whether you bring a glass half full or a glass half empty approach to Brexit. Let me quote to you a couple of senior security figures who do not take the same view as you. Jeremy Fleming, GCHQ director. In 2018, at a NATO conference, he said, "We are leaving the EU, but we're not leaving Europe. We have excellent relationships with intelligence and security agencies right across this continent. We expect them to continue." Richard Dearlove, a former head of MI6, very sanguine about Britain's ability to develop strong relationships with the Europeans after Brexit. So, again, it's a pick and mix. You can hear what you want to hear on both sides of this debate.
Now, well, let's unpack that. Jeremy Fleming is talking about intelligence relationships, and I completely agree with him. Intelligence relationships happen outside the EU now. They will go on happening outside the EU afterwards. So they are not a part of this argument. Law enforcement, judicial cooperation, foreign policy cooperation, defence cooperation go through the EU and will be affected.
Well, sorry to interrupt, but if I may say so, it seems to me the biggest British foreign policy, security, military decision of the past 20 years, the one of most significance, was the decision to join the Americans in the invasion of Iraq, toppling Saddam Hussein. Now, when that happened, the EU was adamantly opposed to that policy. It was Britain, the United States, a few other EU member states like Spain and Poland who supported that. But the EU as a whole, led by Jacques Chirac of France, was absolutely opposed to it. So when it comes to those key elements of Britain's national security policy, it's not the EU that matters most. It's our relationship with the United States and it's NATO.
Well, the EU was absolutely split down the middle. It wasn't opposed. It was split on Iraq, with some countries taking one position, other countries...
The Franco-German motor, which is still at the centre of the European Union, thought that our decision to go into Iraq was mad.
Correct, yeah. You know, and then a lot of people would agree with them that that, you know, was a good judgment.
So when you tell me, though, if we leave the EU, our security, our military, our defence capabilities will be fatally undermined, it seems to me categorically to fly in the face of history and the evidence.
But I haven't said our defence capabilities will be undermined. I've said in a very clear way the internal security issues of law and order and judicial cooperation will be affected. They won't stop altogether, but the police will find it harder, slower, to take more resources to achieve the cooperation that we have now. On intelligence, it won't be affected. On defence, much less, because defence, the EU has a defence capacity, but it's a very modest one. The main load goes through NATO and in our bilateral relationship with America.
Indeed.
And I've never argued otherwise.
And isn't the truth, and you would know this much better than me as a former ambassador to France, that even the French still want very strong defence and military cooperation with Britain, whatever happens about Brexit?
They do, although if you notice, now on the defence industrial side, where we had very close cooperation with the French, for example, between BAE and Dassault over future aircraft and drones, now suddenly all that is orienting towards France and Germany. So on the industrial side, it's more difficult. But just to finish on that point, I think Britain's weight in the world will be less as a result of leaving the EU.
That's the former Mandarin, civil servant in charge of the Foreign Office and a whole load of other things, ambassador to France, ambassador to NATO, national security advisor to David Cameron. He's Lord Peter Rickett speaking to Stephen Sacker earlier this week.
I don't want to see Brexit, but I don't find that kind of argument at all convincing. As we all know, we've just been talking about 9/11 but the NATO, the CIA, that is what really happens. The EU is essentially a vassal state of the US, and that's the reality. And in a sense, all of this stuff about not having cooperation, the German state is dominated by the Americans. And that's why we had a war in Ukraine. As they mentioned earlier, when Britain went to war in Iraq, France and Germany voted against in the Security Council, or abstained. And in actual fact, we'd have been better to listen to them than we did to the Americans. And of course, if we leave the EU, it'll be the Americans telling us what to do, as they do now.
And it was, of course, an illegal invasion. Let's also look at the clashes in Kashmir, because Robert Fisk has published an article this week saying Israel's playing a big role in India's escalating conflict with Pakistan. Signing up to the war on terror, especially Islamist terror, may seem natural for two states built on colonial partition whose security is threatened by Muslim neighbours, he says. When I first heard the first news report, I assumed it was the Israeli air raid on Gaza or Syria. When he heard the news reports of the air raid on Pakistan, airstrikes on a terrorist camp were the first words. Command and control centre destroyed. An Islamist jihadi base had been eliminated. Then I heard the name Balakot and realised that it was neither in Gaza or Syria or even Lebanon, but in Pakistan. How can anyone mix up Israel and India? Well, don't let the idea fade away. 2,500 miles separate the Israeli Ministry of Defence in Tel Aviv from the Indian Ministry of Defence in New Delhi. But there's a reason why the usual cliché-stricken agency dispatches sound so similar. For months, Israel has been assiduously lining itself up alongside India's nationalist BJP government in an unspoken and politically dangerous anti-Islamic coalition, as Islamist coalition, an unofficial, unacknowledged alliance, while India itself has now become the largest weapons market for the Israeli arms trade, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, the BJP in India and Likud and people to the right of Likud in Israel have always had a very strong relationship. And, they see, the Islamic other as their enemy. And, of course, the ordinary people in Kashmir and in Palestine see them as the enemy. And, of course, we're still a long way from any peaceful solution in either of those conflicts.
What about the so-called perpetrators of this sort of inflaming of tensions between India and Pakistan? Jaish Jaish el-Mohammed, the terrorists inside Pakistan. What do we know about them?
Well, as I understand it, that particular group has been banned inside Pakistan, which is what Imran Khan said, whether we banned this group. So you can't say that we did it, but of course there may be elements within the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Agency or the army that may have been helping them. But in a sense, it was a suicide bomber, and he killed about 40 Indian soldiers. Now, if you're going to have a war, that's about as clean a hit as you're going to get. Of course, the Indians didn't like it, but then they're not prepared to negotiate about Kashmir, and the whole question of whether Kashmir should be part of India is a serious one, because there was supposed to be a referendum, which has never taken place, because the Maharaja of Kashmir was a Hindu, and he decided that he was going to put Kashmir as part of India, and that in theory there was going to be a referendum, there never was. So the creation of India, it was about the same time as the creation of Israel, was done on the basis of blood and iron, you know,
reading,
and we're still living the consequences.
Just reading in the Daily Express today, the Indian election latest, the Indian PM Modi's support is soaring with his hard man. He's now supposedly got a tough stance against Pakistan, and he's doing really well in the polls.
Yeah, and if you read Arundhati Roy, who was a novelist but has now become a very, you know, a reportageur, if you like, she is very good at pointing out the role of the research and analysis wing of the Indian army in stirring sectarian tensions within India and elsewhere as a means of political control. I mean, Modi, they brought in, tried to get rid of all cash in the Indian economy, which caused huge problems for poor people, made them very unpopular. But now, of course, they're banging the drum for war with Pakistan, and Modi's opinion poll ratings are
headlines in the Jerusalem Post this week. Jeremy Corbyn calls on the UK to freeze arms sales to Israel after UN Gaza report. The report focuses primarily on Israeli and not Hamas violence, and concluded that the protests were peaceful despite the hundreds of people that were shot dead.
Well, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn has taking the right line on this, as he's taken the right line on stopping arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
It's not just the sort of the line. I think you'll probably find it's a legal obligation.
It is.
Somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to sell arms to people who
That's
are using
right.
them to kill civilians with, and taking pot shots, killing children. It's terrible.
Well, we were hearing earlier on in the first hour about anti-Semitism, but there's also a film coming out called Witch Hunt by Jackie Walker, who was removed from the Labour Party, Martin. She was the deputy head of Momentum for pointing out that some Jews were involved in the slave trade. Now, that was misrepresented by many media organisations to say that she was trying to say that the Jews were behind the slave trade. Well, she never actually said that, and she had no intention of saying it, as far as I can see. And so I spoke to Jackie earlier this week to see what she makes of this latest removal of Chris Williamson, the Labour MP, and suspension of him from the party.
Well, I mean, she is herself Jewish, and lots of people like Tony Greenstein and others are being accused of being anti-Semitic, even though they are in fact Jews. And we had a Jewish Voice for Labour had a meeting in Bristol, which I went along to, and one of the founders of it, I can't remember her name, said, well, I didn't really want to found a separate Jewish group. You know, I'm a doctor and I wanted to support the NHS and so on. But if other people are going to start speaking in my name saying Jews think this and Jews think that, then I'm going to speak out. And Jewish Voice for Labour have been very, very commendable in turning around to other people and saying, look, you can't speak for us. You're not speaking for
one
us.
One of the things Jackie says is that Chris Williamson wasn't actually suspended for his comments about Labour's approach to anti-Semitism, but because he was organising a screening of her film in the House of Commons.
If you look at what's just happened this week, let's take it. A Labour MP is basically suspended from the party because he wanted to put a film on by a Jewish organisation, a pro-Corbyn Jewish organisation. A pro-Corbyn Labour councillor, because she tells a joke that's very common amongst Jews, a pun on the word Jew, is suspended from the Labour Party. I've just heard today that there have been people who are candidates for council, candidates for parliament, who are being phoned up and told literally that if they go and see the film, they will have their candidacy reversed. I mean, if you don't call that a witch hunt, I don't know what it is.
So why is it so controversial, this film, do you think, Jackie? Why are people saying it is?
Well, the people who are saying it's controversial have not seen the film. So how would they know it's controversial? That's number one. I think it's controversial because we're supposed to accept a particular narrative. And that narrative is the one, for example, that we heard Margaret Hodge talk about on Radio 4 three times yesterday morning. Margaret Hodge on the radio talking about the leader of her party, talking about the Labour Party as being a kind of rabid anti-Semite party. The issue now is, just like with Chris Williamson, you can apparently, the only way that you don't get victimised is to accuse your own party of being racist. If you say that that is not true, then you're accused of being anti-Semitic. And I have to point out that, as far as I can see, the chief victims of this at the moment are Jews. What we're talking about here, you see, is not about anti-Semitism. This is about whether you support Jeremy Corbyn or not. I don't know if you remember, but I think it was 2 days ago, a Labour MP stood up in an interview and basically said to be anti-capitalist was to be anti-Semitic, i.e. capitalism is so close to Jewish identity that to criticise capitalism is to be anti-Semitic. Now, can you imagine? That's an outrageously racist thing to say. That's exactly the kind of thing the Nazis said. Now, why hasn't she been suspended from the party? The reason is that she's a critic of Corbyn.
Well, in actual fact, at the Labour Party conference, there was going to be a screening of the film, and somebody phoned in a bomb threat, and it was cancelled, and nobody's been caught for that, but they should be, and if you find out who called in that bomb threat, you might find it leads back to the Israeli embassy. You might.
There's also, yes, there's the lobby, isn't there, an Al Jazeera film all about that. But anyway, time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon on BCFM. You'll find this show's podcast at thisweekoneword.org.uk and a load of links to the stories from tonight. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Martin Summers will be back again next week, we hope. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. Thanks for Ian Henshaw, our guests, and all the rest of them. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Sky News Centre.